Good evening. Welcome to our second Connecting the Dots. We are very lucky again to have Kelly and Charlie, who will be leading us into an informal hour of discussion. And I'm going to turn it right over to them because they're going to fill you in on some things, including the date of the next one, the title of this, and a request that they would like some help from you. And I also will again put in a plug that we're so appreciative of people who've donated money to help make these series continue. And if you haven't, please do take a minute and show your support by donating some money on our website. Thank you. And Charlie and Kelly, I turn it over to both of you.
All right. Well, I'll just start by saying, just to clarify before I forget it, that Sunday, the next one of these will be Sunday, May 20th, the same time, same station, I guess. And
channel.
You're right. And the topic of that one is going to be called. We're finding our way in settling on topics without knowing yet what we're going to talk about. But we've settled on a topic that's going to be called Being Radical. That grew out of one conversation that we had about just various things about how to live life and how to try to do things in our lives. So we'll come back to that on May 20th. I'll just say about this one, and then I'll ask Kelly to answer a question. This one's called Foibles, Quirks, and Shortcomings. And obviously it has to do with things that are problematic, to say the least, and yet of a certain nature that are kind of a certain universe of things that we have trouble with. And but really the suggestion of these exact words came from Kelly, so I'm going to just ask you, Kelly, What were you thinking? Where were you coming from?
What was I thinking? Well, you know what? I actually put this out. I was looking for a way to describe a particular dilemma I was experiencing, and it was like it was worse than a foible, and it wasn't quite a quirk, and I could not come up with what it wasn't a weakness, it wasn't a character flaw. And so it just got to me to thinking that it was coming out of a source of pain in our relationship, you know, just really trying to figure out how to make our way forward. And so that's what was interesting to me, is these ways mm-hmm. that we are that cause distress to others. And then what do you actually do about it? So that's mm-hmm. what got me going on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would love to, you know, hear kind of, I know we probably have gone in different directions as we've been thinking about it this month. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe just to say a little bit about what these are, I was thinking both biological, you know, like how we are, like maybe we're intense or quick to anger, and we've just always been that way, and we've always struggled with it, and it causes all kinds of different, you know, fallout. And what do you mm-hmm. do about it? Or it could be more environmental, you know, like you just don't fit the environment you're in, and if you were in a different environment, it'd be better, or under certain conditions, you really show some sorts of problems or shortcomings in certain situations.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, how's that? Where'd you go with it?
Well, that, I was at, I guess at first I didn't take a ton of time thinking about it. It just kept coming back to my mind, and I kept coming across things both in myself, in the people close to me, and in people that I treat in therapy. And I kept thinking, now, is this a foible? Is this a quirk? What is this? I mean, what are those things? These are not in DSM-4. You know, these sound a little bit like, they, you know, they, for one thing, they sound like the kind of things that would be, they don't just come and go. They aren't like a momentary thing. I mean, mm-hmm. when you talk about foibles or quirks or shortcomings, usually I think you mean it's something that has lasted a while and been anywhere from mildly annoying to totally exasperating. Mm-hmm. And I started, you know, like I had a family came in to a session that I was seeing a family, and one of them came in arguing with each other because one of them had really wanted to be on time, and the other three didn't care as much. To make a long story short, and it really became quite an intense thing because it was like a long lasting thing had gone on for many, many years. This exact difference between them. So I don't know. Is it a quirk that he absolutely insists on being on time for everything? Is it a foible that they don't? You know, is it possible to even define that outside of their relationships? Since, right, you know, if right. late people live with late people, I'm not so sure it's so bad. But so, you know what I did, Kelly, was I started, looking up and thinking. I started writing down lists of what these things are just to try to get my mind around it.
Yeah.
So there were, and then I was looking them up in dictionary definitions. I was looking them up on Google. One of the weirdest things I found, I mean, I just didn't realize this, that foibles and quirks go together. I mean, if you Google foible and quirk, you get a ton of things that have both of those terms in them. All kinds
like
of books. Well, there's even one in England. There's a company called Foible and Quirk LLC. You know, but it had nothing to do with shortcomings or anything like that. But you know, obviously these terms, I just found lists and examples. I mean, I have something here, quirks. Somebody has a quirk who, I'm going to just look at a couple of these because there's 100 of them. Here's a quirk. Carries a large coin, which he or she is always rolling over his or her knuckles. You know the kind of person that's like doing that kind of thing all the time. I mean, which of course sounds pretty benign at the moment, but if you were with that person all the time, you might want to cut their hand off after a while. I mean, I had a grandfather who I never thought of it as a quirk. He was a quirky guy, I guess. He was a guy who loved his electric trains so much that when I was there once and my grandmother wasn't there and she was a very sedate, kind of reserved type, he got the hacksaw out or something and jigsaw and cut tunnels from the living room to the bedroom for the electric train. And then he had the train able to go, and then into the bathroom. So the train was able to traverse the entire house. And then she got back and, of course, she didn't think this was so cute. But, you know, and he, if you reached out your hand to shake hands with this guy, we called him Grandy. Grandy wouldn't just shake hands. He would grab your fingers one by one and count the names of your fingers in Danish. I mean, that's a quirk, right?
I wondered where you got that from, Charlie.
I do. That's right. Well, I don't do that. I do play my head sometimes. But, you know, and Cindy Sanderson used to just be in the middle of teaching, and then, or you'd be teaching. I don't know if this ever happened to you when you taught with her. Then she would just, from out behind a table, she'd have all of her fingers would have finger puppets on them, and she would just start having them dance around and stuff while you're teaching about validation or whatever topic. It was very quirky. Anyway, I found about quirks and foibles and shortcomings that it looks to me like we're talking about two universes of behavior. One universe are foibles and shortcomings and weaknesses and flaws and all kinds of things like that are really, you know, painful for both the person who has it and often for people around them. And then there's quirks that really don't carry the connotation necessarily of being shortcomings or failures. They're just different. They're eccentric. They're odd.
More like personality cowlicks or something.
Yeah, right. Like aneurysms of the personality. You know, it's like little weird formations. And that have, and one other thing I wanted to say about these terms is that the difference between the way these terms sound and the impact they really have is huge. So that foibles and quirks sounds almost funny or cute. But if you get down to any one of them, and it's really long-lasting, it can really be a source of such pain and such trouble in relationships. I mean, my own foibles, my own shortcomings, I don't know, my quirks are probably some of my better features in relationships when I think about it. But, boy, the foibles and shortcomings, the term doesn't capture the pain of it. They sound window dressing terms.
Yeah. Euphemisms, I think, is what you said earlier. And there's a kindness or maybe a tolerance that's conveyed maybe with it. But that is what made me interested in this topic is it's the pain in relationship, the way how we are bugs another person are actually really our shortcomings, like the ways we come up short then impacts others, but also the the internal reaction, the disappointment with yourself over and over as you try to shape up or get with a program, or you know what I mean? It's the recurrence, the kind of everlasting nature of them that was really on my mind. And then what do you do about it, really? What can you do?
Well, I think what's amazing is that these things, whether they're in ourselves or someone else, the shortcoming of, let's say, foible doesn't really capture it. When, for instance, earlier in my relationship at home, I don't know where this came from, because maybe it came from just what I'm about to say, because my mother was a really kind of fastidious, organized person. You know, she had Christmas dinner ready in August. You know, it's like in the freezer, things like that. And I was so not like that. And so come into this marriage a long time ago, and I would leave towels in different places, you know, after I take a shower. And at first maybe you would say, oh, there's a foible, you know, there's a quirk, or even a quirk if you're being generous. But it didn't take long before it was really like a headache, because that wasn't how my wife was. And she really didn't appreciate that. And she asked me to change it, and I intended to. And then, like 2 years later, I still intended to. It was like unbelievable. And so one of the things that I find about some of these things is that they don't look very hard to change. I mean, it seems like, you know, you said something to me earlier about, working on trying to be kinder in certain situations. God, I mean, that just sounds like, oh, okay. But you'd think you can just change these things, but they are incredibly hard. I'm going to, you know what I'm going to do, because we're not going to talk about this later. I told you earlier today that I was thinking of writing a little poem about quirks, foibles, and shortcomings, about the terms. And before we get into anything else on them, I thought I'd read it, because now I've got it. I wrote another thing, too, that I might read later if I get the guts here about it, because it's a little bit more out there. But the quirks, foibles, and shortcomings... It's just two verses. Would you rather have a foible or a quirk? Would you rather be a screwball or a jerk? As recipients of blame, we prefer the kinder name, since we'd rather be upset than go berserk. Shortcomings is a nicer way to say that I've been a loser yet again today. It saves my self-esteem when I want to cry and scream that I've failed again to find a better way. So that's the sometimes when I do these things, sometimes the thing emerges for me that I'm trying to think
Repeat
of.
The last line, because that's really it to me.
It saves my self-esteem when I want to cry and scream that I've failed again to find a better way.
Yeah.
About the shortcomings.
Yeah. That's really it. This how to be with that actual fact. And you know, I'm not sure which direction we might want to go next, but this idea of changing, you know, the efforts to change, I definitely wanted to talk with you about that. Because there's mm-hmm. so many different ways of approaching it, and it seemed like to me, as I was thinking about this, the modal way that we all muddle through is, you know, you might apologize, you might do a little something, and then you kind of scoot right on by it, or, you know, really not make too much change on these things. But
yeah, you know, and then how many apologies?
Yeah.
Can you add up?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, how many before you've gone over at the deep end of apologizing?
Well, that was the thing. Yeah, so I think that's the modal, and then the other is this kind of Pollyanna-ish oversimplification. You know, like people are always full of advice. Oh, well, you should just, you know, and then fill in the blank. Or
right.
a Hallmark card kind of version of how to approach it. And it does, the difficulty and the pain of it is really where I was thinking, like, what does one do? And I don't, so that would be the direction I would say, is to really spend some time mm-hmm. thinking, okay, so what do you do
mm-hmm.
when again and again you come up short, you know? But it's not, it feels like it's more who you are comes up short.
What? Who you are comes up short.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this kind of abiding quality of oneself.
I mean, can you? And this is then it raises a question, and we're still so early in doing this sort of thing that it's hard to know how you'll respond to this. But whether there's an example that you're thinking of or something that's within the realm of what you can say, because.
Yeah.
Because they're all different, but they have something in common of being incredibly frustrating, enduring patterns.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, starting to think about, you know, working on it. One example that I think of is somebody who I love who has had just a long-standing problem with anger. Really quick to fire, mm-hmm. Very intense. And then has worked and worked and worked and worked on it, and still it comes, you know. But after 25, 30 years now, it's a lot less, it happens a lot less and goes as intense. But it's still there, you know, and in those inopportune moments, you know, under a lot of pressure, ends up snapping, and then you can't take it back. You know, you've said it.
Mm-hmm.
So in those kinds of situations, it's like, okay, so what do you do about that?
Mm-hmm.
And
Wait, let me ask you. I mean, what do you mean? What do you do? You mean what do you do as the recipient of the anger, or what do you do if you're him?
Yeah, I think both is really what I mean.
Meant. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think of both. You know, and if I think of him, the kind of responses that are possible. You know, in terms of apologizing and recommitting and working some more. But, you know, it's so painful. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You can't,
mm-hmm.
I think that's, there's some quality in here. One direction I was thinking of a lot is, you know, when you get in that spot, sometimes the shame of it, you know, the failing again sort of quality
mm-hmm.
really trips people up. And,
what do you mean?
Actually,
the shame,
well,
the
so,
shame of it.
The shame
or the person
so
who
I
can't
actually,
change it?
Yeah. And so I actually did a little bit of, a friend and I are doing some work on shame. Actually, there's a great book, by the way, out, Shame in the Psychotherapy Hour.
Mm-hmm.
Rhonda Deering and Jean Tagney had a book come out in 2011. And a couple friends, Maya Sai, myself, Liz Simpson, did a paper for that. And in that, we... You know, the sort of way that shame fires, when it fires, it makes you withdraw and it makes you shut down. And there's some really interesting research about if you think that it's you're seeing yourself through the other person's eyes and being rejected versus you're not living up to your own sort of standards or in whether you think it's global and sort of you can actually change it. So can you repair it with a person, or is it something that you could actually do something about? And if not, if you don't view it that way, the way that you can fall into sort of a more defensive stance or kind of a collapsing stance. And so that's what
I mean. If you don't view it which way, you could fall into a defensive stance.
Well, if you view it as neither something that's reparable, like you can't actually fix your social image, you can't get the other person to actually view you in a way that's more positive. There's nothing you can do to improve your image. There's no tolerance. There's no forgiveness coming. Then you tend to move into a more defensive position, or into a position of kind of collapsing, giving up. More self-hatred. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I'm trying to I'm really trying to personalize it because it makes I find that you know, I hadn't thought of it in terms of shame in this kind of thing, but if I'm not able, if I don't change something and it aggravates someone else, and then I keep not changing it and it keeps aggravating them, and of course it doesn't stand still, it turns into the person gets more aggravated and either withdraws or periodically gets just really upset, and then sometimes it takes that for me to hear it, and then I hear it, and then I realize I haven't been making it a high priority, and then if it keeps going, I mean, there's a way in which it's pretty risky to try to change these things now that I think of it, because there's a lot in them. I mean, there's one that I don't want to go into in detail because I think it's sort of family related, and I don't have my kids' permission to get specific. And once at a training, I said something about my kids, and then they were at a picnic with the people later, and somebody said, "Oh, you're the one who did such and such." And I thought, "Oh my God." And they were really upset with me, and they said, "Why do you talk about us?" I said, "Because you're so fabulous, and you're such good examples." So anyway, there's this one that'll remain a tiny bit generic, but let's just say, you know, with one of my children, where I want my child to handle this situation the way I handle those situations in life, and he's just not that way. He's just not me. And he's just not going to change in the direction that I'm, and it's kind of like I can't believe it. And because it's so obvious to me that the way to, you know, be effective in life is to engage in certain sort of set of strategies, and he just doesn't do it. And I would just be beside myself about it, and then didn't realize, I mean, how bad he was feeling about it. And he's getting really upset about it, and I'm feeling like, okay, I'll back off. It isn't like I'm a total idiot in that situation, but I might seem like it. And I'm sort of learning and thinking, all right, he's got to find his way, and I got to see how he does this. But I'm not really getting it. It's like the difference of 80% and 100%, and so that 80%. Is like, from my point of view, pretty good. I feel like, oh, good, I'm making an adjustment. And then I'm sort of proud of myself or something, but it actually isn't changing the basic situation that once in a while I still fall back and say a certain thing, and it's obvious that I haven't made the 100%. And then it's just as aggravating as before. It's like the laws of intermittent reinforcement. Here it is again once in a while means it's always been there. And so it's just incredibly hard until somehow it gets through me, and not even when I'm exactly thinking of it. And with this situation in particular, there was a certain day when I just thought, okay, this is not my job anymore. I mean, this is it. I'm not just going to be sort of backing off this week. This is the end of my idea that I'm supposed to do this for my son. I'm supposed to impart to him how I've lived certain aspects of my life. And I just sort of somehow, I was actually in our kitchen, and it was when I was focusing on it. I just realized, I thought, you know what? It's over. And it felt like a great relief, and it felt like I knew exactly what to do, which was easy to state, but, you know, hard to change, which was, don't do it anymore. Just don't. You don't have to go apologize anymore. You don't have to do anything. Just stop doing that, and then when you have the urge to do it, you just don't do it. Somehow, it's easy to say. I could give someone that advice, and it wouldn't work. But, you know, and I actually changed. It's one of the examples in my life where I actually changed so radically that my son called me, you know, in to talk with him, like, maybe 2 months later, and said, Dad, you have just changed about this so much. I just want to tell you, it has meant the world to me. I just so appreciate it. And I thought, oh, my God. I mean, and then it sort of shed light on how bad it was before that and how I had been defensive. But I don't know how it might have had anything to do with shame, but I have a feeling you might be onto something there. I just don't know what made it so hard to change for several years of obvious data. Saying, don't do this anymore.
Around your throat, yeah.
And really, I mean, it's sort of like you'd have to have been there a few times. I mean, between what he was saying to me and then my wife saying, you know, don't you think you should listen to him? I mean, I think he's on to this. I think you've got to hear what you're doing to the relationship with him. And that's what ended up mattering most. I still go through it. I mean, this is like a year ago this happened, and I still see him and I think, Jesus, he should do such and such. And I just have to let it go.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah,
how do
I
you
think
just...
that's just, well, I think that's really fascinating, though. It's I think every single person has been in that spot where you, I mean, it's interesting on that one because there you are, you're trying to get somebody else to change their shortcomings or their perceived shortcomings in your
exactly.
view.
That's actually true, right.
Yeah, and then, and running up against it again and again and again. And then, you think that you got in, but it took some further, I'm just thinking of my own life, like there, it's not like I haven't known, I'm thinking about how important it is to get that kind of feedback and how you can hear it and hear it and hear it and you just don't quite get it.
Well, you know, the thing that got this going in my mind was when you were talking about getting defensive, because I think what happened for the longest time was I would hear it, and I'd hear it with sort of half of my brain or something, and the other half would be saying, yeah, I should listen to this, or I should be like I'm listening to this, but actually, he really needs this from me. And and so I wasn't really letting go. If anything, I was just kind of like seeing, well, I know better than him. And so, but it had a defensive quality to it, and I don't think I could change it while I was defending myself. And how do you get yourself to get out of defending yourself? I mean, I think there's a lot of ways to do it, but I think in a way when I said it happened when I wasn't focused on it, it kind of happened, I think, when I wasn't defending myself. And I don't know what the exact circumstances were, but something must have shifted because it seemed all of a sudden so obvious. And I do think it had to do with our bouts of talking with each other and being mad at each other about all this and me thinking, God, I want to do better. I really care about it. I really don't want to be hurting this relationship. And then finally, somehow, it just kind of like, got to me. I think maybe he got bolder himself of saying what it was doing to him. And I had to wake up to the fact that my preferences, as strong as they might be about these things, I had to let go of them. I had to let go of really believing that they were the way to go. And by doing that, I was afraid I was leaving him sort of like adrift. Like, oh no, if I stop doing this, he'll be stuck. You know, he won't have anybody doing this with him. And he's got to do this. I had to somehow realize that was just a really strong belief of mine. It did have a defensive quality. It had a defensive quality because it was kind of like, my way, much as I seem like a kind of a democratic, decent guy, I mean, I can be a real, you know, I am a Taurus. And I've been told that makes you not only a bull, but sometimes a bully. And, you know, because you so believe in your way of doing it. And it was really, that was really hard. That's hard. And I don't know, I think there is shame. There's shame of, God, if this isn't right, the way I've been doing this, you know, then I must really be screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
I must, you know.
Yeah, I really appreciate that story.
You know, I was watching an interview. I mean, I know him so well, and I don't. But Les Greenberg came up in another context of my life last week, and I was watching a long video of him treating somebody, and if I am imagining now one of the avenues to try to change this, it would have been, though I don't know that it was in this case, but it would have been for me to realize how thoroughly connected what I was doing with my son was to my own experience, that without going into enormous detail, just feeling like I couldn't let go. And it was a very powerful thing. I couldn't let go. This was a hard word learned strategy in life. And I was reacting to the fact that I felt like I kind of brought myself up in a context of very busy parents. And I had figured something out that a son needs from a father. And somehow it was very painful. I mean, there was a place of real pain. To let go of doing this would be to let go of a lifelong conviction of, you know, that wasn't always on my mind, but a conviction that this is what my son needs from me. And so it's, I think it's sort of these things that last, even if they don't quite make it to DSM-4 criteria, they really are rooted.
Yeah.
And how to get in there and get them out by the roots, or how to just understand the roots.
Understand the roots, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's making me think of is, and the reason this whole topic was on my mind too, that in therapy, as therapists, sometimes the reason the therapy isn't going well is because of how we are or who we are as therapists, in the same exact way that you were just describing. And sometimes it can be really hard to get the kind of feedback. I had a stretch where I was getting this feedback that I had a couple of people where they felt really humiliated. And it's just like so far from my self experience. It's like, how can that be? How can that be? Because I mean, you know me, and it's like that's so far from my experience. And what ended up happening is I ended up role-playing with a colleague who knows me really well, and we just reenacted a couple of the interactions. And she said, you know what happens is when you start to do, like I was doing a chain analysis to figure out what the controlling variables were, when you shift and your interest goes up, it so narrows down that it feels like scrutiny. And you become so focused that there's no sense of warmth anymore. And, you know, like, and so if you're there and somebody's really looking at you and really with you, and my experience is I'm just really invested and you know, like super attentive, but on the receiving end. And I just think this ability to get the kind of feedback about where you are off and its actual impact, sometimes it's hard for somebody to tell you, you know, exactly why what you're doing is off or how it's impacting them. So it's hard to sort it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, was there a certain point, you know, that kind of feedback? I mean, what got through into
your mind?
It's
immediately through. It's just I could not figure out. I was like, okay, well, is it this? Is it that? Is it the other thing? You know, like trying to figure out what is it I'm doing and changing what I'm doing. And, you know, it was really hard to sort it out. Like, I had no idea my warmth went down when I got super.
Mm-hmm.
It really took somebody watching or somebody who knows you well being bold enough to tell you, you know. So it wasn't like I wasn't right on top of, like, it's like, okay, there's something happening. But mm-hmm. to figure out what it was sometimes, I think is also hard. You know, like I can think of a lot of different people who I consult to where very subtle things like that you're a little prone to guilt or you have a little bit of difficulty observing limits or when you get stretched in your life, you're a little not quite there, you know, emotionally. These different things about how we are, who we are, end up sort of weakening a little bit the fabric of the therapeutic relationship or maybe even causing more stress, but mm-hmm. our clients can't always tell, and I think tell us what the problem is.
But Kelly, about that, this example, which is really good and very, I appreciate you sharing it, is that this, I would imagine that what you're describing would be actually really hard to change. Because it really is something, and I know you, and I know, you know, you and I have talked a lot before in the past, and, you know, it is true that your mind, when you get going on a problem, your mind becomes very focused on that, and it, I think it, if warmth goes down during that, I mean, that would be a hard thing to change. Because there's actually a lot of powerful reinforcement for working that way.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's like we got finite resources in our brain, and you're like putting 98% of it for a while into figuring this out, which is not the same as the 98% into really grasping the other person's experience of you figuring it out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what did you...
Yeah, you know what?
I'm both interested in how that got through to you, because that's a big deal. And then also, what did you do?
It was through to me. It was trying to figure out what I was doing. And I know other people have this too. It's like you're seeing different, you know, like you see people pull back, or you see relationships not go as far, or there's, you know, you see the aftermath. But you can't see the cause, like you can't tell what you're doing, and maybe nobody tells you. You know, either because they can't, they're not sure themselves about why it's not quite there or whatever. I think about people when they're dating, you know, like what's not quite there. So this one, what ended up happening is it provoked me to read a lot about shame. Like I was trying to figure out, okay, what sets off humiliation? So it turns out status, you know, if you feel like one person goes one up. But the other is some really interesting stuff about warmth, actual physical warmth. This is a little too tangential, so I won't bring in all the different ideas here about it. But
mm-hmm.
But what ended up being helpful is I think of my attention as sort of a laser beam. And what I ended up trying to do is then radiate like the sun, like bring on actual physical warmth. Like if I was the sun and if I was warm enough, then, you know, laser doesn't show up so much in the bright light.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to amp up my expressions of warmth overall. And often when I'm paying attention these days, I actually physically feel like I'm trying to radiate warmth. You know, like I'm a sun shining on all things equally, and try to create that experience. It seems like it's working. I mean, I've definitely had feedback now that it's changed. But, yeah, it was, so for me it was this.
I don't, but I still don't get how you got that. That's, I could see that being really different if you can maintain doing that, but I still don't see, how did your understanding shame get you to make a shift where that kind of like imaging came about? I mean, were you, are you talking about shame that you experienced?
No, what talk, I feel like
you're talking
there was
about shame
about
that you
my,
would in you would set off in other people.
I was
people.
Somehow setting off. I was setting it off through that sort of focus, that not through criticism, but by intense focus. It felt like scrutiny. So intense focus in the absence of warmth can come across as a kind of a one-up move, you know, like the alpha dog sort of a move. Mm-hmm. And so that the other, if it's sustained, then, you know, you're supposed to submit. You're supposed to go one down. And I think it just sets off. It doesn't have warmth. That particular type of intensity, sort of a body posture of leaning forward and looking, really can set off.
So do you think it was a big motivator of you once you grasped that you were triggering shame?
Yeah.
In someone else, that really got through to
it really got
you
through.
Thinking, well, I don't want to do this, you know.
Yeah, but I didn't know what the this was. That was what took so darn long.
Well, then you needed to learn more about what this was.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. One of the problems I have with this sort of thing is that when someone else gives me feedback that I hurt them in some way, or ask me to change a certain thing. I think this has to do with just the magnitude of my sort of self, that I listen to that, and then I think, well, what do I think of that? And from that moment on, it's downhill in a way. I mean, it's not. I don't mean it to be downhill, and I don't mean that I don't try to do constructive things. But once there's a way in which, you know, like a more Zen point of view about this would be that actually the other person and I really are the same humanity. We are the same being.
Yeah.
That the boundary between us is a sort of a nice conventional thing, but actually we deeply affect each other. And so if somebody else says to me, you know, you hurt me or I wish you would change that, if only I could just hear that at face value, that I should change that, you know.
Yeah.
You live once, and this person I care about wants me to change that. I may or may not be able to change it, but I should change it. Rather than thinking through, well, what do I think about the fact that they think I should change that?
And
then it's gone. It's sort of like it's already too much in my own head. It's very not interpersonal.
You know, that makes me think of, I was talking with my friend Mavis about this topic, and she is a kind of person where if you tell her something, you know, that's bugging you, she puts 100% of energy into changing it, like immediately, if she can. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what? You what? And I actually have started trying this. There's this phrase about taking 100% responsibility for the relationship and expecting 0% back.
There's this what?
Not a phrase. Taking 100% responsibility, but expecting 0% back. And that kind of a radical move of really doing it, so that I was going to change whatever was necessary for the interaction to go better,
myself. That's something that is very hard. I have to get to that point where I'm going to put the 100% in, but seems like it takes longer than it should to get there.
I took it as a thought experiment the other day, just to see what the impact of it was. Mm-hmm. It really makes things different.
You mean you did
experiment. I just thought, okay, so I know I'm going to get into a particular thing that was coming, and I just thought, okay, what if I actually were going to go through that thing that I knew was coming, this interaction I knew was coming, and I was going to take 100% responsibility for getting it to go well. Mm-hmm. I was going to mm-hmm. change whatever about myself mm-hmm. to make it go mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. And I just let myself watch what, you know, what would unfold and be different. I didn't actually do it.
I think that whenever I have done that, and I can remember, for instance, I think in working with people with borderline personality disorder so much, you know, in addition to just being who I am, as I've already just described it a minute ago, about getting in my own head about these things and having to figure it out myself rather than just take something at face value and say, oh, okay, I'll change that. Then in addition, if you're treating somebody with a lot of sensitivity and reactivity and sometimes with, you know, black and white ways of putting things, it's really hard just to take it. But in fact, some of my best, I don't know, not just moments, but trends in therapies that I've done probably come from times that I just somehow have done that. And the person has said, you know, it feels to me as if you're really gradually shutting me out. I can remember a person saying, you know, and really like as if, you know, you're acting like you're still here, but I don't think you're still here in the same way that you were in the last few months. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of like with this person at this moment in time, for whatever reason, I just sort of let it be. I said, this is true. This is true. Before I even knew why it was true, and I felt ashamed that it was true. I felt bad that it was true. I felt like I hadn't even noticed that myself, but as soon as this person said it, I thought, it's totally true. And I said to the person, you're absolutely right. And I don't know why that's happened exactly, because it isn't obvious to me why, but I do think that I am less here than before. So where I go with that, or where we go with that, I mean, let's talk about, but and it really was a great moment because, you know, it's just great. It's like once when I, early in my relationship with my wife, and I grew up playing sports, watching sports, coaching sports. You know, it's been a big part of my life. But my wife grew up with none of that, like zero. I mean, -3 of that. I mean, sort of like the idea that she would have, you know, a husband and then two boys that are all into sports was never crossed her mind. I'm not sure what she would have done, but she sort of like, I remember early in our relationship before we even had the boys, and it'd be a football game on, and I'd want her to sit with me and watch the football game. I don't know if that's a quirk or a foible or what, but, you know, and I felt it kind of strongly. I kind of thought, I'll feel pretty lonely if I'm just watching, you know, and then I'll have to go out, and I could go watch with other people, but I tend to be a lot with myself. And so she actually just said, okay, I'll try. And when I look back on that, that has been her model in many ways. If I explicitly ask things, she's like your friend Mavis. She just says, okay, I'll do that as best I can. Now, it turned out that didn't work out that well. She would sit there, and she would, because I wanted her not only to sit there with me, I wanted her to be enthusiastic about it, and she couldn't do that. I mean, that was sort of, but once I realized she couldn't do that, I just thought, I just had to mourn that was not going to be a thing we're going to do together. Now, it turns out, because the kids play sports, we've spent zillions of hours sitting at hockey rinks watching them play hockey, and she never would have thought that, and we sometimes have a good time with that. Hey, Kelly, I want to...
Yeah.
What?
Well, I was just thinking that there's a long haul nature to these things.
There is.
We were just saying, yeah.
There is. These are, you know, you take the history of the coming and going of one quirk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, someone could write a long book on the coming and life, the lives and deaths of a quirk, or the lives and deaths of a foible. I mean, it really is. These are not small things. And yet there's a zillion of them, and they are taken so lightly. So I'm going to read you my other poem before more time goes by, because I went to the trouble of writing this. And it sort of flowed out of my head, as some do. And it basically, because it's, I was really working on, you know, what these things are so damaging that they end things sometimes. And they also are hard to change. So I went into writing this based on that, and there's part of it, there's one little you'll hear part of it. I don't know if you remember, I mean, or even with your own child, whether you've reread this or whether you read it as a kid or had it read to you, but the poem called Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod.
No,
do you remember
that?
Did you not know Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod? Oh, it's a great poem. You should get it. Find it. It's just on, you know, on the internet. Winkin', Blinkin', and Nod, and it's about these three. Well, you find out what they are at the end, but it's a story that's a wonderful story. So some of this is sort of patterned off of that. But here's how it goes. It's called Shortcoming, Foible, and Quirk. The decree went out on a summer's day in 1957 from the mayor of Normalville, the closest place to heaven. "Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye," he said with normalcy. "It's time to send the weird ones far across the sea. They aggravate. They irritate. It gets worse every day. Just think how normal life will be when they are far away. It's time to tell these miscreants we won't take any more. Have them pack their oddities and gather at the shore." Shortcoming, Foible, and Quirk that night sailed off in an ugly boot, exposed in the glare of righteous light, sailed off in disrepute. "Where are you going and what do you wish?" the old moon asked the three. "We seek to find a rock to grind our eccentricity. If we could smooth our rough spots, we think we would be free." The old moon laughed and shook his head as they rocked in that ugly boot, and the wind came up and off they sped. For once, the three were mute. They crashed against a mighty rock, just as the three had planned. But when they smashed against it, it crumbled into sand. Back to the boot, back to the sea, went Shortcoming, Foible, and Quirk. They were losing hope, but said the three, "Surely some hard rock will work." The search went on for days to come as each rock fell apart, till they crashed into a diamond mine. And the three of them took heart. "Diamonds are the hardest things. There's no doubt that they will work." But every diamond turned to dust, leaving Shortcoming, Foible, and Quirk. The wind, it howled. The waves, they crashed. The moon appeared above and shone upon the sorry three with smiles of moonly love. And soon their shame dissolved in the light as the old moon helped them see that Shortcoming, Foible, and Quirk were they. It's who they were meant to be. And they learned to love just who they were as they sailed the brightening sea. There they are.
I love that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's making me think, Charlie, of Tara Brach. She has a really beautiful mindfulness where on the inhale you ask, "What is this?" And then on the exhale or sometime later at a rhythm that works, you ask, "Can I be with this?"
Mm.
And the acceptance that's involved in understanding and being with. I love that poem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, can I be, especially, you know, we didn't get to this part and we're coming towards the end, but, you know, we talked a lot about the commitment to try to change these things and how hard it can be and just a little bit of how it might happen, but, you know, what if you can't change certain things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I think of people with attention deficit disorder and I think of Russell Barkley's work and how he once, and he's been quoted many times as having said this, but, you know, you have a kid with ADD that just can't get themselves to do things. And he pointed out that you could hold a gun to their heads and they still couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they still couldn't do it. It isn't like within the wiring at that point. So there's, you can develop more of it and there's all kinds of compensatory strategies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like at a certain point, it can be quite a relief if you just decide this is who I am. You know, this yeah. this thing is going to be hard to change in this lifetime. Now, you and I had agreed when we talked earlier today that at this point that we might try something a little different where we just have a couple minutes. And so I'm going to ask, I'm going to ask you, and then you can ask me, though I don't know what my answer will be yet, of what we've talked about. And then, by the way, those of you who are listening, we would like to ask you, too. I mean, this would be our main. If we had one question to ask you after this is done so that you could sort of type it into Perry's, you know, the survey that will go out with certain questions. Here's the question. What's going to stick with you from what we were just talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say this thing that we got to about the need to really radically accept the truth of what the other says as deeply as we can, like to make that be the first move. Mm-hmm. I think that's it. I think for me, that's, I think that's, there's a real truth in there that's going to stick with me. Mm-hmm. How about you? What would you say?
Well, I, you know, I think that that is going to stick with me, too, except just accepting the truth of it. I mean, it's something that I said, but actually in saying it, I heard myself say it, and I heard you hear it said, and it helps me get it more, that is something that's just so hard for me to do, and it really almost every time makes a difference. I mean, almost never go astray, but I always think I will. The other thing I think is just the degree to which these things, which if we were talking about geology, are just kind of like some kind of formations. Mm-hmm. But they're very enduring, and they're very hard to break down with all the hard rocks and even diamonds, you know, that what is in there is a story, a background, like the one, the background, I felt like I learned a little bit more as I was talking about this thing about my son, about my own background of what I brought to it. There is considerable pain, and the pain of loss in that case, in that I had the difficulty I had giving up what I was doing had to do with that I was convinced from earlier in my life, I mean deep in my soul, that he needed this from me. And it was something I did not get from my own father. And so I think the, as I even think of that, I think the pain that is in there to just allow myself to experience and to soften it a little bit might make it more possible for me to just realize how complex it is, that it's not a question that I have the right answer for my son. It's like 4 zillion answers possible. So, yeah. So I think I'll take that. And also what you just shared at the end about that mindfulness practice from Tara Brach sounds, I wrote it down, and I really like that, so I appreciate that.
Well, Charlie, so that was...
This is it.
That's it? That was a very...
Really
enjoyable, ranging around.
It's 9 o'clock here. Just wait. You have 3 more hours before it's 9 there. The hour from 8 to 9 will be really great. It's always funny talking to you, the West Coast.
Yeah.
So we should stop. People should be able to sign off and do what they need to do on their Sunday evening. And that was, I really appreciated that, Kelly. So we'll start generating thoughts about being radical.
Oh,
what that
yeah.
means to us.
Lovely. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Well, take care.
So, Perry, do we do anything in signing off, Perry?
No, I'll sign you off. Thank you, both of you. And, Charlie, do you want to send us what you wrote? I think everybody always appreciates it if you want us to post your poem.
I'd have, you know, it's written in a form that actually no one but me can read it, and that isn't because I'm trying to keep it secret. It's because I can't write very well. But I'm going to, I'll type it up. I mean, if you say that, Perry,
yes.
I'm just gonna start practicing now. That if you say that, it's true. So I'll just send it.
That
we'll see if it. My first thought was, come on, Perry. People are sick of these things. And so I'll just bypass that and I'll send it to you. Both of the things.
Terrific. Okay. Thank you. I don't think you can appreciate how meaningful all of this is. It's a very unique experience to sort of be, it's almost like eavesdropping. And it's a wonderful experience. So I'll thank you for all the callers who can't say it to you directly.
Okay, great.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
All right. Thanks, Perry.
Bye, y'all.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.